You're listening to the CEO Series with Carl Moore on the iHeartRadio Talk Network.
Welcome to the CEO Series. I'm Carl Moore from McGill University. Each week, the CEO Series takes you inside the minds and lives of some of Canada, indeed the world's top leaders, to discuss strategy, leadership, and today's pressing organizational issues. And some of the world's top leaders have spent time with us, like Justin Trudeau, Muhammad Yunus, Nobel Peace Prize winner, and Dr. Joanne Liu, International President of Doctors Without Borders. This show gives you a thin, well, perhaps not so thin slice of the kind of thoughtful leaders leading some of today's most interesting organizations. Today, I'm delighted to be speaking with General Wayne Eyre, Chief of the Defense Staff, the general who is in charge of Canada's military forces. Thank you, General, for joining us today.
Well, Carl, it's great to talk to you today, and welcome to Ottawa.
Tell us about your early years. Where did you grow up, and what did your family do back when you were a kid, General?
So I grew up on a wheat farm in Saskatchewan. And so my family farmed wheat, barley, canola. And so I had the freedom that growing up on a farm offered. Now, my family sold the farm when I was 14, and we moved to Medicine Hat, Alberta. And so I got a little bit of urban, albeit smaller urban, experience growing up as well.
So my uncle Jack, my father grew up on a wheat farm just out of Side Marengo, not too far from Rosetown. So I guess you were from that general neck of the woods.
Well, I was on the other side of Saskatoon, about 2 hours east of Saskatoon, a small town called Wadena. But I had a great aunt that lived in Rosetown, so it's a small world.
And I worked in Regina for a couple of years. So we used to go to Winnipeg for excitement, which only people from Saskatchewan can say.
Well, I did 7 years in Winnipeg as well. In fact, I got married in Winnipeg. So yes, we had a lot of excitement there.
So what did your family was doing farming? What was the family doing up in Medicine Hat?
They went into the motel business. Yeah, sold the farm early 80s and went into that business.
That's quite a dramatic shift. I mean, today we talk about being fluid and stuff like that, but your family did that. I guess for them, you're probably too young to realize that that was a pretty dramatic thing to do.
Oh, it was a significant shift. And you know, I was 10 miles outside of the town of Wadena, you know, population 1,600, and all of a sudden moving to the big city of Medicine Hat, that was a bit of a shock as well.
What did you want to do when you were growing up, General? Did you always want to be military, or was there some, you know, police officer or some other thing in there?
I knew from an early age I wanted to join the military. You know, whether it was playing with toy soldiers very young, leading my brothers and cousins, patrolling through the woods with our sawed-off hockey sticks, joining Army cadets at the age of 12, it has definitely been a calling.
Clearly, you're a leader today. The most senior general in Canada, 4 stars on your uniform. When did you realize I might be a leader? Was it high school or university? When did it occur to you I might be a leader?
Well, so going through the Army Cadet Program, as you are progressively promoted in rank, you're given leadership opportunities. Yeah, I realized at that point that, yeah, I enjoy doing this. I enjoy operating in these small groups, leading these small groups, and you know, this is something that I could do. This is something I want to do.
How big is cadets? Some of my students are in cadets, but give us a sense for the younger listeners. How big is cadets in Canada these days, and when do you join? Do you have a sense for that?
Yeah, so cadets is the largest and arguably the most successful youth program in the country. It's affiliated with the military. There's Army, Navy, and Air Cadets. Lots of summer camp experiences. It's not so much focused on military skills as it is citizenship, leadership, and other life skills that are so important, regardless of what life's path takes you down.
A number of my students who come from immigrant families, like it seems to appeal, particularly immigrants, as a way of becoming more engaged in Canada in some way.
So I've noticed the same thing. My own daughter did Army Cadets, and I saw the changing face of cadets along with the changing face of Canada. And so it is a fantastic opportunity to get to know your new country better.
What did you study at university, and where did you go to university?
So I went to the military college system, 2 years at Royal Roads Military College in Victoria before it closed, and then 2 years at Royal Military College in Kingston. So I have an undergrad in or a bachelor's of science and applied science.
In what subject?
It was material process or signals processing and material science, but with many electives in history. And in fact, most of my, well, all of my master's degrees are focused on international relations, history, strategy formulation. And so I was actually more interested in my electives than I was in my main subject.
So what? Why history? Why is that interesting to you?
Well, it's hard to know where you're going if you don't know where you've been. And so understanding history provides such a great context for what we're going through now and where we could be. I find it tremendously useful for my current role as we look at history, historical analogies to various conflicts and crises around the world. History doesn't repeat, but it certainly rhymes, as has been said many times. And we can see that now. Understanding how we got here, understanding the historical context and the many operations we have around the world is incredibly important. And I just find it fascinating.
And it suggests directions. If you know where we've been, it tells you there's kind of a limited number of choices of where we're going to go. Is that a fair statement?
Yes, but you got to be careful as well that you don't you don't become too deterministic. When you're looking back at history and see it as a natural path forward, there were certain events. The play of probability and chance is incredibly important in the course of history, as is giving agency to historical figures who make these key decisions. Some big events in history could have gone one way or the other, depending on decisions different leaders make.
So who are two or three of the great leaders in history you particularly admire?
Well, I am a big fan of Eisenhower's, and you take a look at the coalition that he had to build in the Second World War, and just the weight of command he had during that war, and how he was able to balance the politics of the moment with the operational necessities and succeed. And subsequently, when he became President Eisenhower, he didn't have an easy role there either, but he certainly was able to tackle many challenges. He's one. You know, another from history is Marcus Aurelius. And the challenges he faced and the lessons that he captured in meditations, you know, stand as an example for many, many today and throughout history. I'm also a big fan of fiction. And if we take a look at other leaders, Aragorn from Lord of the Rings stands as an example as well from literature, one to emulate. Just the humility with which he approached his, some would say, destiny.
Depends on your schedule, but how many books do you think you read a year or so? I mean, it depends what you're up to, but these days, is it more than a couple?
Oh yeah, absolutely. I haven't counted, but probably in the neighborhood of 30 or so.
Wow.
Plus, the staff keep giving me more and more to read. So I probably read, I was thinking this weekend, Saturday morning, probably read 200 pages of staff work and reports and other articles of interest.
So when you read stuff or see PowerPoints by, you can smell kind of when it's good or when there's something awry. I remember I had Paul Tellier, who ran the government and ran Bombardier, that he would just want to see number 17. Like, I don't see, I've read them all.
Yep.
That's the one. And he would know when to kind of drill down because the person just didn't have it quite there and think about it.
Yeah.
I guess you've seen enough that you can kind of sense that.
Well, it allows for intuition. And so if intuition is based on mental mindsets and pattern recognition, that the patterns that you get are from your life experience, and if you want to increase them, you can draw them from others' experience as well.
Okay.
And so reaching back into history, others' experiences, other activities, you don't necessarily have that right at the top of your memory, but it's in there in that pattern bank.
Okay.
And so to get better intuition, you expand the bank of patterns you have for pattern recognition.
So I teach strategy at McGill, and one of the things I talk about is, I learned this at Oxford, that the word strategy to a considerable degree comes from the Greek word strategos.
Yes.
The view of the general. So in some ways you go like, you guys have been at this longer historically. So when we think about strategy, what is strategy in your mind?
So strategy has many definitions, as you're well familiar with. You know, in my mind, strategy is a balance of ends, ways, and means to be able to accomplish an objective. And if you don't have the ways and means right, well, you have to adjust the ends. And that at the national level is a dialogue with government. They set the political ends. They often give us the resources, and we set the means. We set the ways, and often those ways are discussion as well, because it's not a free-for-all as to how you accomplish the mission. And so it is all conducted generally in an adversarial environment, because you've got a thinking, adaptive enemy on the other side that you have to take into consideration. And I've come to really appreciate, I've always known theoretically, but certainly in this role, that military strategy is what is but one part of the overall grand strategy, as it gets incorporated with the other elements of national power, diplomacy, information, economics, all of those other levers of government out there, and integrated, so you've got national grand strategy. And it's much easier said than done, because theory and practice is are two different things.
Today, I'm delighted to be speaking with General Wayne Eyre, Chief of the Defence Staff of Canada, which is the commander of the Canadian Armed Forces. I'm Carl Moore from McGill University, and you're listening to the CEO Series. Next up, we'll ask the General how he makes decisions for the future, given his knowledge of the past and the very tumultuous circumstance of today.
Notch insight from proven leaders. This is the CEO Series with Carl Moore on the iHeartRadio Talk Network.
Hello again, you're listening to the CEO Series, and today I'm sitting down with General Eyre, who is the commander of the Canadian Armed Forces. Who do you work for? Who's your boss?
So
it's the Canadian people, I understand, but
no, that is a great question. Day to day, I work for the Minister of National Defence.
Okay,
but I'm also the Prime Minister's military advisor and military advisor to Cabinet. My commission is granted by the Governor General, and the Clerk of the Privy Council has a pretty big say as well to what I do. So balancing off those, not balancing them, but being responsive to all of those is. Pretty important. And understanding the relationship and having a good relationship, very important. But I also work for the people in the Canadian Armed Forces to make sure that they are set up for success, that they have the wherewithal. And if they don't, making sure that we don't put them in a set of circumstances that they're not going to succeed.
So you're the voice of the military person, the average person in the military, to the minister, to the prime minister. On the other hand, you'd also reflect the cabinet's decisions to the military and say, okay, here's what we've got to do because we've been tasked with this. Now, the military, the minister and the prime minister, by definition, do not have the experience you and the military would have, by definition. So how do you, I had Mark Garneau come to class, and he talked about how, as a minister of transportation, he would do a couple hours meeting every day, and they trained him. Got him knowledgeable, very respectfully, and let him decide. But he said by the end, the meetings were shorter because they had trained him.
Mm-hmm.
So it's sort of thing where how you've got to work with the minister and the prime minister. Not, training is a strong word, but how do you educate them, work with them, so that they understand the issues from the perspective of the armed forces?
So it's
I hope that was polite enough.
No, absolutely. It's a constant dialogue. But as Elliot Cohen would put it, author of Supreme Command, it's an unequal dialogue, because a fundamental principle of democracy is the military is subservient to duly elected civilian officials. And so in those ends, ways, means discussions, you have to be able to articulate risk as well as you present options. And more so, I'm presenting opportunity cost. And so it's a discussion back and forth. So for example, the political ends that the government may wish to achieve is not achievable by the means that they're putting into it or the ways available. And so calibrating those political ends and having that discussion to let them know that, okay, that's not achievable, but this is. And so it's a lot of back and forth, but at the end of the day, the unequal part comes in. Well, government tells you to do something, you know, you do it.
So a certain degree, there's the discussions, the end of the day, the prime minister, the minister decides, and you might literally, well, you probably don't literally salute, but you go, yes, sir.
Oh, at the end of the day, yes. But there has to be that dialogue first.
Okay.
And so that risk is understood and what is achievable is understood and what the opportunity cost is. If you ask us to do this, we will not be able to do that.
Okay. And it's something where, now part of that is saying, I interviewed the General Martin Dempsey, mm-hmm. taught with him at Duke, and then interviewed in the Pentagon. He has a huge office. You've probably been in it, mm-hmm. or you know whoever the chairman is. One of the most interesting things he said is, generals fight the battles of their youth. So he was a pup lieutenant out of West Point, tank in the Cold War, learned about leadership. He was taught by men and women that had been in Vietnam, learned about strategy from them, and then he was generals in the Desert Storm. So you've had some compelling lessons from your 20s about
yes.
how to lead. And you had people that were in World War II or something teaching you. How do you throw ideas over the side of the boat? That's a Navy thing, but maybe I know you're in the Army. But anyway, the Navy reports to you. How do you decide what to throw away and what to retain?
So there's some lessons that you don't throw away. And you talk about lessons of your youth. So, you know, that picture on the wall behind you is my platoon in Croatia in 1993, shortly before the Battle of the Medak Pocket.
Wow.
And that was Canada's largest engagement since the Korean War. And one of the lessons that I continue to use to this day is to not put our troops in harm's way without having all the necessary preconditions in place, all the necessary enablers such as fire support and medical evacuation and line of communication, logistics support and proper intelligence because we're not setting them up for success. So, you know, lessons like that get burned into your psyche based on those experiences of your youth, you can't throw those overboard. But there's others that as we see the character of war rapidly change with changing technology, with changing ways of integrating that technology that have to be discarded. And if we didn't, otherwise we would still be riding cavalry into machine guns. We're seeing that right now play out in Ukraine. With the character of war rapidly changing. Autonomous systems, the digital environment in which militaries are operating, just the power of the information environment. Clausewitz said that war is a contest of human will. That has not changed. The nature of war hasn't changed. But the way that human will is being affected through disinformation, through foreign interference, using the platform of social media to affect the will of our society. So that is how the character is changing, and embracing those new ideas is absolutely essential. It's been said that warfare is a case of adaptation, and the side with the will and the ability to adapt the fastest is going to win. And so we just have to have change as a constant, especially going forward as we see an acceleration in all sorts of change that we're facing, whether it's technological change, societal change, climate change. We're facing some pretty challenging times right now.
You sound like almost every CEO I talk to in every industry says a lot of the same, because this is the world we live in. So in some ways, we've got to be more adaptive than the past, throw away some of the lessons from the past. Technology. How much, we're meeting the Minister of Technology when we're in Egypt in a couple weeks. How much has technology impacted the military?
Oh, it absolutely has impacted the military because our means of operating are all technologically based, whether it's fighters, whether it's ships, whether it's the weapons that our soldiers use, and more importantly, how they are networked together. Mm. And so it's been said that right now we are in the middle of it's been called the mature precision warfare revolution, where if you can see it, it can be targeted. If it can be targeted, it can die at further and further distances. And it's harder and harder to intercept some of those precision weapons that are coming up. And so the integration of sensors, of shooters, with a very, very rapid command and control system is fundamentally changing the way that we operate.
Well, we see drones, things like that. Someone sitting in the States can send a drone and kill someone, and they're safely thousands of kilometers away. It doesn't seem fair, this technology, but the technology in the hands of the right military is a great thing and keeps us safer and keeps the soldiers safer.
Yes, but you're seeing the proliferation of that technology to the point that you've got super empowered individuals. Mm. And we've also got, for the first time in 70 plus years, peer adversaries who outmatch us both in terms of quality and quantity of equipment. And so there are countries out there that are that have different beliefs, different aspirations, different value systems that want to remake the world order in their view, that have some very, very significant capabilities that, quite frankly, are what the Americans call pacing threats. And what they mean by that is, okay, this is where you judge your level of capability.
Today I'm delighted to be speaking with the Chief of Defense Staff of Canada, which is commander of the Canadian Armed Forces. I'm Carl Moore from McGill University, and you're listening to the CEO Series. Next up, General Ayer tells us about Canada's military reputation worldwide and reverse mentoring in the military.
Exclusive access to some of the most successful leaders out there. This is the CEO Series with Carl Moore on the iHeartRadio Talk Network.
Hello again, you're listening to the CEO Series, and today I'm sitting down with General Ayer, who is the commander of the Canadian Armed Forces. Back in the day, the general would be on the hill making the decisions because he or she would look down and I'm not involved in the battle, but she's out there and someone's trying to kill her and she, you know, like you're in the midst of it. On the other hand, today that lieutenant now has the same information the general had in her helmet. So in some ways we go, oh, let her make the decision, she's there. And we don't, is that some truth to that idea that the information is now with the people in the field, not so much back in headquarters?
Well, you could say it was true at that point as well, as militaries have become more dispersed. So what you're talking about, the era of heroic leadership when the general could see everyone under their command,
yeah,
and command it directly. As we've moved away from that and become more dispersed, the concept of empowerment has had to come to the fore. Now, there's a danger with technology that it works both ways, is that the general sitting back in the command post can see everything that young lieutenant is seeing. But if the general focuses on that, the general will become very quickly overwhelmed with that amount of detail. And so that's why the concept of mission command is just so important. And what I mean by that is explaining the why, you know, giving the purpose for the mission, giving the resources, and letting the individual on the ground figure out the how. So empowerment is really the watchword here. We're expecting, and just to take this one a little bit further, we're expecting much more out of our junior leaders than we ever had in the past. The junior leader, the lieutenant, the captain of today has got to have the same sort of historical knowledge, cultural understanding of local dynamics, politics, the contextual information that in World War II we would have expected a general to have, a brigade commander, a division commander. The other aspect is being able to work as part of a multinational coalition, being able to have those cross-cultural competencies. I remember 15 years ago in Afghanistan, I saw a young lieutenant commanding a Canadian platoon of 30 troops. Attached to his platoon was an engineering section, an American forward air controlling team, Dutch F-16s overhead, a South African dog handling team, an American embedded training team with another Afghan platoon of 30 Afghan soldiers attached. One young Canadian lieutenant, and he was doing an excellent job. And so continuing to develop our subordinates with that level of understanding is a challenge, but our people are up to it.
When I travel around, and I lived in England for years, people were nicer to me when they learned that I was Canadian. And they assumed my accent, I was American, then they'd go, and I go, oh, not my president, I'm Canadian. And all of a sudden, I was a nicer person. I could also defend America, because I didn't have a dog in the fight. But, you know, I lived in the States and love America. So Canadians, the military is, they're the sharp end, but they're nice people. Is that kind of the view of the Canadian military around the world?
So we are well appreciated around the world. Our allies love working with us. They want more of us. Tactically, we punch above our weight. Strategically, perhaps not so much. But our reputation as individuals is well deserved. You know, what I've noticed about the Canadian soldier overseas is their ability to breach cultural barriers, to work with many others, and bring people together. It's something I'm proud of. It's something that I've noticed, and it's something that others have noticed as well.
Well, part of it, we have the English-French thing in Canada where there's the other, but there are brothers and sisters. So it's part of our DNA, because, and we're not American. So there's kind of, you know, we're the small brother of America. Yep. So it's an interesting set of dynamics that works out there. So hierarchy has declined in your time in the military.
So hierarchy is still there, but there's a cultural aspect called a power distance gap, which I suggest has become less. And so our junior ranks, our junior members, are much more willing to question, to pose questions, to approach senior leaders and ask why. You know, why are we doing this? And so the change in leadership is providing that why. You know, start with why. You know, this is the purpose of what we're doing. It's not as you would sometimes see in the movies of salute and carry on. It's, okay, we need to understand the purpose behind this mission.
And they may say, how do we not only what the purpose is, but how do we deliver on that? They may have opinions on that, which you'll take on board to some degree.
Yes.
But then at a certain point you go, okay, heard the discussion, here's my decision, and then they move on with it and give you feedback, but there's kind of a moving on. So you're reverse mentored by young people. I get, well, not to rub it in, but most everybody's younger than you and I, so we can't help but be reverse mentored. But is it something where you would listen to much more junior people on a regular basis?
So you, in today's day and age, you absolutely have to. With things changing so fast, getting ideas from wherever they may come from, having that diversity of thought, experience, and expertise is absolutely critical. And so that speaks to a leadership attribute, which is essential, which is humility. Realizing you may be the most experienced person in the room, but you're not necessarily the smartest. You don't have an answer for all of the issues that you're facing. And so what having that mindset, you know, creating that psychological safety where others can speak up, others have the comfort to know that they're not going to be ridiculed if they bring up an idea. So you can bring this rich menu of potential solutions forward. Absolutely essential in the challenges we faced.
Mm-hmm. How did you develop your presence?
Well, I don't think I know there's not a course that teaches you to develop presence. It comes through unconscious example. It comes from experience. It comes from watching others. But I've never been asked that question before, but upon, you know, just very quickly reflecting on it, it's not something that I put a lot of thought into, to consciously develop presence.
But I think it's something where you watch generals when you were a young person and you go, okay, that's what a general does. And you watch people or colonels that had presence. And when they walked into the room, there was a sense of energy that was helpful. Are you an introvert or extrovert, General?
So I am very much an introvert. And I am most comfortable at home with a book, but I have developed extrovert skills to get out in front of a group of people, to talk, to approach strangers, to be in a social setting and walk up to a group of strangers and insert myself into that circle. So absolutely required.
That was just part of the job.
Yeah, but I do get energized by having a town hall, by getting out and engaging with people. But I know where my energy comes from, and my energy comes from going home or just being by myself to recharge the batteries.
But it's interesting because our traditional view is all leaders are extroverts, but About half the CEOs that talk to are introverted or in that general direction. But it's the nature of the role, I guess, to a certain degree. Have you been shot at?
Yes.
Where?
Former Yugoslavia, numerous times there. Afghanistan, several times.
So you feared for your life, rightly so.
Yes, but nothing is as dangerous as Ottawa.
My undergrads wonder if they're going to have grandchildren because of climate change. Hopefully they're a bit wound up about it, but they see it, and I think rightly so, as the world's biggest problem.
Yes.
War and so on is a worse problem in some parts of the world, but how is the military thinking about climate change, and what are you doing about it?
Yeah, so we take a look at the geopolitical situation right now. That is short term. You know, all of the challenges that we face out there, that is short term. Climate change is really the long term threat, not just to our country, but to humanity writ large. Yeah, so what are we doing about it? Well, we continue to respond to climate change related disasters. You know, last summer, we had troops deployed for 131 days straight fighting fires in six provinces and territories. And it's only going to get worse. So from a domestic response perspective, how do we continue to posture ourselves to be able to respond while at the same time advocating for more capacity? Because it's not just a military role, there has to be other capacity out there. But we also have to take a look at how this is going to affect other parts of Canada, the North in particular. So what do we need to be able to respond to climate change up there? There are security-related issues as the North becomes, as the Canada's Arctic becomes more accessible. With that increased access comes increased interest. With increased interest comes increased opportunity for tension, miscalculation, et cetera. And so increasing our security presence up there directly tied to climate change is important. But we also have to have an understanding of how climate change drives conflict around the world, as it has throughout the history of Homo sapiens. Small changes in climate can be the can determine if a tribe is survivable or not, and consequently it drives human migration. Well, we're seeing massive human migration now. And so what are the security implications of that? So it's something that we are definitely thinking about. It's not just a military problem, but military has got significant equities in it.
Today, I'm delighted to be speaking with the Chief of Defense Staff of Canada, which is the commander of the Canadian Armed Forces. I'm Carl Moore from McGill University, and you're listening to the CEO series. Next up, we will ask General Eyre on his view of the changing global powers given the rise of China.
They made it, and they're telling you how. You're listening to the CEO series with Carl Moore on the iHeartRadio Talk Network.
Hello again, you're listening to the CEO series, and today I'm sitting down with General Eyre, who is the commander of the Canadian Armed Forces. You mentioned the Arctic and something where, you know, we have our American friends to the south, you know, with great peace there. But when we look to the north with the opening of ships there, but also Russia and China are there, and Norway, which would be seen as an ally. Tell us about the Arctic and how that may evolve over the next 20 or 30 years as something that the military in Canada has got to think about.
So I think we have to be thinking in those time frames, first of all, 20, 30, 40 years. You know, our sovereignty today, tomorrow, next year, next decade is not under threat. But if you take a look at the Canadian Arctic, we have the same landmass as Europe, with a population of 100,000. Our sovereignty is not a given. And as the Arctic becomes more accessible, there are many who are interested. China and Russia are cooperating in the Arctic as they have never before. You know, traditionally, this has been a wedge issue between them. But given Russia's isolation after its brutal invasion of Ukraine, it's becoming more and more subservient to China. And so China is operating more in the Arctic. Russia is, you know, sees the Arctic as a vital national security interest. Late 2022, they passed a domestic law saying the Northern Sea Route is a domestic waterway, completely against UNCLOS. And so we have overlapping maritime claims with Russia in the north. And the fear is they're going to take a page out of the Chinese playbook from the South China Sea and start building, continue to build what we call anti-access aerial denial capabilities, which means they're going to occupy it by force. They're going to present a fait accompli. And what that means is we need to get up there. We need to have presence. We need to understand what is happening, and we need to be able to respond. And this is going to take decades to put in place because of the, not just the challenges in acquiring the capabilities, but the challenge in putting in facilities in the Arctic in a rapidly changing environment. As the permafrost melts, building infrastructure is very, very challenging.
And it's going to take a lot of resources as well.
Mm-hmm.
When we were younger, it was Moscow and Washington were the two poles of the world. Today, it seems more like it's Washington and Beijing, but it's a different world. How do you see that world evolving, and what's the role of China in the world in your mind, in your experience?
Well, what we're seeing is almost a multipolar global order, which is inherently more unstable than a bipolar world. And so you've got a number of like-minded nations, Russia, China, Iran, that are becoming more aligned, but it'll never be a natural partnership. There's just too many differences in their societies and differing values. And so you've got multiple poles there. And so achieving some form of stability amongst those is very difficult. You know, think deterrence theory. In the Cold War, the U.S. and the Soviet Union only had to deter each other. You know, now is you've got multiple countries with nuclear weapons that can deliver over strategic distances. How do you deter against specific countries? And deterrence against one, how is that not seen as aggression by another or a threatening move by another? And so this multi-body problem, if you will, is become very complex. That being said, we're also seeing a globally integrated threat environment. And what I mean by that is you have China, Russia, Iran, to a certain extent North Korea, operating more and more together. And we've seen North Korean shells and ballistic missiles being fired in Ukraine. And so Russia and China cooperating more together. Russia and North Korea cooperating more together. We talked about the Arctic with Russia and China. You see Iran, who, you know, given what's happening in the Middle East right now, is the focal point of much of this chaos that's happening. You know, having greater and greater relations with Russia, and so, yeah, this axis, this integrated threat environment that we're facing means that us here in Canada, we're no longer as insular as we once were.
So in one way, you know, World War II didn't impacted Canada enormously, but no one invaded us.
Mm-hmm.
And we were protected, and the U.S. only really Pearl Harbor, and then there was a submarine or something off the east, but relatively we're, but today's world, we're not as isolated as we were in World War II.
No.
So that's going to lead to, it's a much more complex world out there for sure. I do a column for the Globe and Mail where I interview Indigenous leaders. And it's probably, I do with an Indigenous physician in Montreal. And what we're trying to do is just say, for too long we ignored Indigenous wisdom, it's time to listen to them. Tell us about the armed forces and how they're taking on board more thinking about and involvement with Indigenous people.
So certainly in the Arctic, as we increase opportunities, we increase activities up there, Indigenous engagement advice is extremely useful and valued. We have a program called the Canadian Rangers, who are reserve members, a special form of reserves. In the north, the 1st Canadian Ranger Patrol Group is mostly Indigenous, using traditional knowledge. As we project capabilities to the north, their role is our eyes, ears, and guides, advisors, if you will, extremely important. We are bringing more and more Indigenous members into our ranks. In fact, just this morning, we were briefing the Governor General on the Indigenous Leadership Opportunity Year at Royal Military College in Kingston. And so those types of opportunities to better educate ourselves about the role of the indigenous population in this country is something that we continue to work on, continue to develop.
So in some ways, their knowledge of the Arctic is unique and centuries old, can actually help the military do a better job if we just take the time to listen and think about what they're saying.
But what we're finding from our rangers up there who have based, whose knowledge is based on that traditional knowledge, whether it's navigation, understanding of landmarks and the like, with climate change, a lot of that is changing. And so you don't have the traditional wind patterns, snow patterns, and the like. And so they're having to adapt as well.
One of the things I'm talking about in my book on Generation Y, WHY, is that in postmodern thought, when I was younger at IBM, if anybody got emotional, we'd stop the meeting and have coffee as soon as emotion reared its ugly head. Where my undergrads see rational thought and emotions as much more equal than our generation did. I get irritated by that occasionally, but I think they're right. What is the view of emotions and thought from your perspective?
Oh, they are co-equal. And if you take a look at how decisions are made, the emotional component is significant. And so understanding emotions, you know, being self-aware enough to understand your own emotions, to put labels on them. I've recently read Brené Brown's book on labeling emotions, and it's quite useful to understand the differences and being able to understand what you're going through and by extension understand what others are going through as well. It helps you with empathy. It helps you with emotional intelligence. It helps you relate to those who are around you and those who work for you.
We want authentic leaders these days. General, what is an authentic leader in your mind?
So I think there's a number of aspects to what an authentic leader is, you know, being truthful and forthright, even if it's if you're not covering yourself in admitting mistakes, being honest as to what you would have done differently, ensuring there's no say-do gap, so what you say, you actually do. Having a sense of humility, I think, is very important. There's a book I've put on the reading list of all our general officers. It's by Ryan Holiday called Ego is the Enemy. And very, very important, because if you let ego take over, it's a recipe for all sorts of disaster. Vulnerability, you know, realizing and saying that you don't have all of the answers is important, and providing space for others to speak up, to provide ideas. In this rapidly changing world, super important.
This has been the CEO Series. Thank you very much for speaking with us today, General Ayer. Thank you also to our show producer, Gabby Hartshorn-Mell, our technical producer, Marco Campagna, and our scriptwriter, Stephanie Richet. And to our listeners, as always, thanks for tuning in. À la prochaine.